Welcome to Bridging the Bones, a podcast exploring the causes, context, and potential solutions to conflict. I'm your host, Sotaline Wang.
Or even the origin of COVID, for example, right? Conservatives largely doubled down that it was a creation from China and the Wuhan lab and spread that, and liberals said that was racist, wanted to suppress that. They said it definitely came from nature. Now, 5 years later, there's a debate about the origin. We don't actually know. But everyone got into camps and tried to censor each other and silence each other with not knowing. I mean, those are the kind of problems you get from a society that's fractured and awash in false information.
Our guest today is Dr. Nolan Higdon, author of The Anatomy of Fake News, A Critical News Literacy Education, published by University of California Press. We start off with a discussion of what mainstream media, quote-unquote, means in today's wide media landscape. I think most people are used to thinking in terms of like mainstream media versus, you know, alternative media. You do something different in your book.
Yeah, I've never been a big fan of the term the mainstream, because in my lifetime, like I said, we've had about 5 to 6 corporations controlling 90% of news media, about 5 to 6 controlling the internet. These 10 corporations to me are not the mainstream. They're a very niche minority group of rapacious, profit-driven corporations. To me, the people are the mainstream. So it's, what are people creating? What do people care about? So what's often called alternative, I think, is more the mainstream. But more importantly, I think you can tell a lot about what a news media will report based on its funding model. They're never going to, especially in a capitalist society, they're never going to report on things that are going to undermine their profit model. So, when, you know, Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, he's a founder of Amazon. He's not going to have pay for the Washington Post to rip his Amazon profits. You know those sorts of things inherently. And so that's a way of saying that who funds the media matters a lot. So instead of using mainstream versus alternative, I like to use corporate versus independent. The corporate media are owned by corporations. They tend to report content that is favorable to the corporate interpretation of the world. And then there's other media, which I call independent media. They're independent of corporate funding. They may rely on, say, foundation funding or government funding or subscriber funding or private funding, and that's fine. But it's different than that corporate model. They're motivated by something else. So I make that distinction when I talk about the different kinds of media.
So, I mean, it sounds like we're focusing a lot on large corporations and the ways that they frame, right? And the ways that they potentially include or exclude stories based on what they want. So from your perspective, is industrial propaganda something that's always been with us, or is that something much more recent?
Corporate propaganda posing as journalism has been around for as long as the United States has been around. You can go back and look at folks like Jay Gould and Company in the 19th century were buying up newspapers to promote their industries. Famously, you know, William Randolph Hearst was a big media mogul at the end of the 19th century. So this has been a long time coming. This is not a new practice. You know, rich people realize very quickly in a democracy that they may have all the money, but the one thing that works against them is the voters. They don't have enough votes as one rich person. So if you buy up media, you control information, you can control the voters. And we've seen that as rich people have done that historically and in the present day, right? We've seen Larry Ellison recently invest in a lot of media, including CBS for his son. We've seen Elon Musk, of course, buy the Twitter platform and rename it X. Jeff Bezos, who I mentioned a moment ago, bought the Washington Post. We know the Adelsons, for example, bought newspapers in Las Vegas. So rich people...
The Murdoch family.
The Murdoch family, yes. Can't forget them. They created an empire starting in Australia in the 70s and expanding the globe at this point. These moguls do this constantly to control the flow of information. And that's why it's important for audiences to know that the information they're getting, it can be true, but it's generally filtered through the interests of the wealthy. And so if it's trickling to you, it probably serves some purpose for the wealthy as well.
You also devote some time in your book to government propaganda. And you noted one of the reasons why cynicism developed about the role of the government in the media was the government influence over reporting on the government in Southeast Asia, specifically in and around Vietnam.
The news media in the United States was very liberal at that point, and what I mean by that is they really believed in government. They believed that the U.S. government would do well and would not lie to them. And a lot of reporters were basically taking content directly from the government and reporting it to the people. This included this idea that we were quote unquote winning in Vietnam. And we can debate whether or not winning ever existed, but winning in that framework meant that the North Vietnamese were just about to surrender. Then you get the holiday of Tet in 1968, a huge uprising that illustrates that that was a lie. People could see directly before them they were being lied to.
I think you're referring to what's known as the Tet Offensive.
The Tet Offensive, yes.
Right.
And this was a massive event that showed to the public government was lying to them. And it was just a few years later you get Watergate, where you find out that the president Richard Nixon was not only lying to the public, he was using his position in government to illegally do campaign finance, break and enter, spy on enemies. And then in order to kind of repair the image of government, you had this senator named Frank Church, who called the Church Committee hearings, and he said he was going to do a big Senate investigation into government. He was going to expose all the lies as a way to reassert faith in government. And this is the first time the public found out about things like, the CIA had journalists on its payroll. This was called Operation Mockingbird, where they were operating in the United States, or that intelligence communities and the FBI were spying on civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King, or that the CIA was going around the world trying to assassinate world leaders, including Fidel Castro. So all this stuff comes out. Rather than react by having faith in government, the public turns against government at that time. And so the government really got kind of put on its heels. A lot of liberals found themselves defending government, while conservatives kind of cashed in on the boogeyman that government's the responsible for everything. So that's where that kind of pessimism about government lied. But the whole time, the US government was really focusing on trying to propagandize international audiences. So during that whole time period, the governments, like so many governments at the time, whether it be China or Russia or the Soviet Union back then, they were creating fake news and other propagandistic content to try and get people to their side. Remember, this is the Cold War. So communist countries are trying to get these countries coming out of colonialism to be communist, and capitalist countries like the US are trying to get them to become capitalist. And so they're using propaganda to convince these audiences. And until 2012, Congress had allowed the federal government to create propaganda, but it wasn't allowed to distribute it domestically. Then in 2012, they updated what was known as the Smith-Mundt Act. And the Smith-Mundt Act was the one that said you federal government cannot propagandize domestically. They changed that in 2012, which effectively allowed the federal government to start spreading propaganda to domestic audiences. And that's been going on now for about the last 13 or so years.
Or I should say, how has the change in telecommunications laws ramped up party propaganda or government propaganda?
Both. So, basically, without the fairness doctrine, you don't have to balance viewpoints anymore on your show. So if you want to have a outlet that is completely all Republican propaganda 24/7, you can do that, and the government really has no legal mechanism to stop you. With consolidated ownership, audiences don't have other choices in the traditional media sense. So if they want to watch cable news, they only have a handful of channels to choose from. And what these companies started doing when they saw that the market had fractured, there's less channels and there's more options in terms of, like,
There's more choice.
yeah, more choice, the internet, things like that. Instead of trying to go for the biggest demographic possible, which is what they used to do. So in the 1950s, you would try and get 150 million people to watch CBS News at night. Today, no serious outlet would do that. They know they cannot get 150 million people, but they may be able to maximize their money from, say, 10 million. And so they have to find kind of a demographic that they want to cater to that doesn't have other options. And so what these companies have typically done is they've tried to look for people with money and who have a particular ideological bias.
Wait,
So,
so just to
go
clarify,
ahead.
when you say demographic, you mean a group of people with some kind of common characteristic?
Yes, and typically, like I said, they've aimed for people who are wealthy, so you're middle to upper class suburbanites, because again, the name of the game is making money. So you want to draw in advertisers to advertise. If it's poor people who don't have any money, advertisers aren't going to come. So they usually go to middle class, wealthy people, and then within that demographic itself, they chop up that demographic smaller and say, okay, within those wealthy people, some of these folks are Democrats, some are Republicans, maybe some are like centrists. So one does their programming to get the Democrats, one does to get the Republicans, one does to get the centrists. And so even though there's people who are left of the Democratic Party or to the right of the Republican Party or people who challenge, say, capitalism or democracy, all those viewpoints, those don't get represented. It's this very narrow group who are represented on these channels. And one of the ways in which they found that you can keep audiences like almost like a pro wrestling type programming where it's good guys versus bad guys. They like conflict. And so they tune in, they tell you your world viewpoint is correct. They publish stories that confirm your world viewpoint. And they also confirm your viewpoint that the other side is crazy, mean, beyond repair, irredeemable. And they show you horrible stories about them where you can boo at them just like a bad guy in pro wrestling. And this model, has really worked in the cable television era of the late 20th century. And it has worked really well in the social media era, which has the same kind of business model in a sense. People will keep coming back to a platform if it confirms their worldview and gives in to their fear and hate about the quote unquote other side, whoever that may be. So it's really a business model that's made for false information because it doesn't matter what's true per se. It matters that we feed into existing biases. And that's exactly what fake news does really well.
Talking about how the internet and social media create a sort of ecosystem for fake information, for propaganda to fester, to grow. What is particular about the internet that distinguishes it from the cable TV era?
Yeah, it's a really, really great question, and it brings us back to this kind of critical point that the internet could be anything. So the idea that like smart devices or even AI are inherently bad is misleading. Really, the problem is that they're owned and controlled by a narrow group of companies who have reduced them to being for profit. So in the internet age, what this means with fake news, though, is that you have to remember when the commercial internet emerged in the late 20th century, there wasn't really an understanding of how you could make money off it. And we had this dot-com bubble burst in 2000, and people were searching around for a way to make money off the internet. And oddly, one of the events that helped found the new internet economy was 9/11. After 9/11, the government was concerned that they weren't able to monitor communications in digital spaces. They wanted to work with big tech to get access to information on the internet to,
Wait, so
hopefully.
just to clarify for our non-US audiences, when you say 9/11, you mean the airplanes?
Right, in a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. So four planes by 19 hijackers were hijacked. One crashed in World Trade Center 1, one to World Trade Center 2. Three buildings fell in Manhattan, even though two were hit by airplanes. The Pentagon was hit by a plane, and then another plane crashed in Shanksville, and there's a debate about whether or not the passengers took control and crashed it or what happened there. But the
So
government
I'm
was,
sorry, yes. Going back to your point.
So the government was very afraid at that moment. I want to be able to monitor communication. And so they worked with these tech companies to get access to what people are doing online. And that emerged a new economy. Tech realized that all that data they had been kind of throwing away or not using was really lucrative. A lot of companies wanted to know what people are doing. So, for example, your health insurer would like to know how little you sleep or how much you smoke. Your car insurance would like to know how fast you drive. Your advertisers would like to know what kind of products you need or want. Politicians would like to know your vulnerability on certain issues or whatever. So they realized there was this market for data. So the question is, how do you get maximized data? Because the idea being the more data you get, the better insights you can make about people. And one of the ways you do that is by keeping people addicted to their screen. And this is really where social media emerges. Social media, we have the naive idea that when we sign into the internet or our social media account, we have access to all the boundless information. That's not true. The algorithm decides what we see and don't see, and it feeds us stuff that keeps us on our screen. So, what keeps people on their screen? Things that confirm their worldview or things that appeal to hate and fear. Those are exactly the content that fake news does well. It confirms worldviews and engenders hate and fear. And so, fake news, and studies have shown this, spreads further and faster than truth. And even when, there's a popular fake news story, if someone debunks it, the debunk doesn't spread as fast or as far as the lies. And so that's really what the internet economy has done. And the reason for this is the internet economy stole tricks from the gambling industry. So if you go gambling, some slot machines will pay like 80 to 90% of the money you put into it back to you over the long stretch of time. So if you have $100 and you put in, $10, you lose it. You put in $10, you lose it. You put in $10, you win back five. You get this dopamine hit because you won, but you're still down $25. So you keep chasing that dopamine hit. So you put in 10 more, 10 more, 10 more, 10 more, and then you hit five. You're like, yes, gotta chase it again, more. Social media does the same thing. We want more likes, we want more follows, we want more comments, we want new friends, we want new followers, et cetera. So it plays into that same gambling sensibility to keep people addicted to their screen. And not only do they do this by using fake news, this also further deepens the fake news problem because the longer we're on our screen, it's showing us the same stuff over and over again. We become exhausted and we start taking mental shortcuts. Research shows that people conflate familiarity with veracity. So the more we see something, the more we assume it's true. And because we've seen it a lot of places and we're tired because we're on our screen so much, thinking so much, we make shortcuts. Well, if I've seen it a lot, must be true. So I'm not going to do any more research. So all those are reasons why this internet economy really contributes to the spread of fake news in a way the legacy media just couldn't or didn't.
We're interviewing media studies professor Nolan Higdon on his book, The Anatomy of Fake News. We'll return after a word from our sponsor. Who's this week's sponsor? Oh, right, it's you, or could be. You might think that information is free because, well, internet. Keeping the lights on, investigating perplexing questions, and interviewing guests does cost something. If you appreciate what we do here at Bridging the Bones, consider making a one-time or recurring donation today on our website, bridgingthebones.fyi. Recurring supporters get access to our bonus content, which includes extended interviews with our notable guests. Give today. This is Bridging the Bones. Welcome back to our interview with Dr. Nolan Higdon. We are discussing how social media and the algorithms used currently for search engines accelerate and amplify the fake news churn, with some dangerous results.
So it sounds like there's definitely a psychological element to this. It sounds like the algorithms are feeding people what they want, or the very least what they will be disgusted by, or what they'll be afraid of. And it's reinforcing these things. I think the term in the entertainment industry is give the people what they want. And so people are getting what they want, but I guess there's this tension, this inherent tension, right? Between what people want or what people can be convinced that they want versus what people who are honest journalists or critical journalists would say would be a healthier version or a healthier version of how to talk about what's happening around us.
Yeah, it's so like Elie Prazer talks about what you're asking there. He talks about the difference between, and he used to work at Google. He talks about the difference between what we want and what we need. So, if you're, so I don't know, take a fake news story from like 2024. Remember that was like that fake news story about immigrants eating pets in Ohio or whatever it was. You may want that story because it fits with your worldview, but you know, the story you really need are the ones debunking it. And so this is where journalists need to be brave, not just journalists, but news outlets need to be brave and have backbones and tell people what they need to hear, not necessarily what they want to hear. The algorithm, you know, doesn't really have any principled worldview or any democratic position where they're supposed to give people what they need. They don't take any kind of journalistic responsibility. And why should they? They're not journalists, right? They're advertising companies. And so one of the contributing factors, I think, which speaks to your question, is a lot of people, especially younger folks, when you ask them where do they get their news, their number one answer is social media. Social media are not news outlets. That is the inherent problem. And to this, you have to go back to the early 2000s. A lot of news outlets didn't realize how powerful the internet was going to be, and they started giving away their content for free. Well, if you do that for enough years, or in this case, decades, you condition audiences to believe journalism is worthless. And that's become a serious problem because it's difficult to get the public now to condition to believe that journalism is worth money, especially when they see the stuff in their social media feed as being tantamount to journalism.
So the fractioning, the dispersal of the potential audience is itself a destabilizing force in society to some degree.
Yeah, because you've got people stewing about things that like most of the public doesn't even know. Like there was that woman who was killed on a train that a couple like a month or two ago, and this blew up in right-wing media because it was a white woman and a person of color had killed her on the train. And the right-wing media was freaking out because they thought this story wasn't covered, and they compared it to the coverage of like George Floyd's murder, and they were trying to make the case that basically the news media is so liberal, it won't cover white victims of people of color. That was kind of their argument in this little space. But they didn't realize that millions of murders happen to people of all racial identities that aren't covered by every news outlet. So, you know, all around the country, murders happen that aren't covered. But they chose this one and they fixated on it. To them, it was a major deal, and they're fixated on it. And when they go out and talk to people who are in different media environments, they don't know what they're talking about. And so they assume it's their bias or they're stupid or they don't care about white victims. It just creates this fracturing sense of culture, fracturing sense of priorities, this disdain and distrust of each other because you don't know what I know and you must not know it because you're in a liberal bubble or whatever it may be. And it makes it difficult to move the country in any substantial direction. You know, just think of like if we had something like God, I don't know, like an alien invasion in this country, like an actual like alien spaceship from some other life being from the
Alpha
solar system.
Centauri or whatever.
Yeah, something like that, right? Let's say that happens. Can you imagine just the division in this country? There would be so many different pockets of the internet. Some would, you know, call it a hoax. Others would try and claim it's Russia. Some would say it was China. And some would try and say we need to welcome them as liberators. I mean, it would be total insanity. We don't have that kind of monoculture anymore. And so it makes it difficult not only to deal with tragedies like the absurd example I just gave, but also to solve problems.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the response to vaccines and masking in 2020, 2021 was a very good demonstration of that.
Yeah, that was a very very apt demonstration, right? We had a global pandemic, and you know, it really necessitated every country's people pulling together for the good of the people, not the individual self. But in the United States, we just divided into this, you know, toxic world of false information and hyper-partisanship. There was a New York Times study that showed that if you identify as liberal, you dramatically overestimated the amount of deaths by COVID. If you identified as conservative, you dramatically underestimated the deaths by COVID. If you were So, I mean, you can go on down there, or even the origin of COVID, for example, right? Conservatives largely doubled down that it was a creation from China in the Wuhan lab and spread that. And liberals said that was racist and wanted to suppress that. They said it definitely came from nature. Now, 5 years later, there's a debate about the origin. We don't actually know. But everyone got into camps and tried to censor each other and silence each other with not knowing. I mean, those are the kind of problems you get from a society that's fractured and away awash in false information.
What interested you about media?
I was a college student in 2002 and 2003, and I had happened to be in a class. It was a history class, but in the real world, the struggle over whether or not Saddam Hussein, who was then president of Iraq, had weapons of mass destruction, was dominating U.S. media discourse. And then President Bush was trying to make the case that Iraq was part of the so-called axis of evil, that he and his administration insinuated that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, which wasn't true, and then tried to say that Saddam was procuring so-called weapons of mass destruction, and the U.S. had to intervene to stop the procurement of WMDs before it became another terrorist attack. And remember, this is shortly after 9/11. And I was in a history class where the instructor, it was Mickey Huff, really laid out how historically the U.S. government has had to tell lies to convince the public to support wars, and he was convinced, like a lot of others, that this WMDs thing was a lie. And at the time, polling showed about 70% of Americans believe Saddam did have weapons of mass destruction. Only 2 years later, for even the Defense Department to admit that wasn't true. So I was really captured by the moment of seeing how a media blitz of lies could convince the public to support something in an intervention in another country. And there were people like researchers who knew it was fake and were saying it was fake, but were getting ignored or attacked for being unpatriotic. And so I was just interested, how had this happened, historically in another context? But more so, as I began studying it, I became interested in a different question, which was, well, how do we stop this from happening? What does the public need so they're not manipulated by this content? And that's what drew my interest into media literacy. So that's kind of how I got into media history and media literacy.
I'm looking on social media, and I'm sure, as you're well aware, there's a lot of narratives and counter narratives about AI and artificial intelligence, how it's influencing, what we're seeing, what kind of images, what kind of videos, they're influencing news feeds. I think there's definitely a vocal group of people who are claiming that, well, the best solution to these illusory realities is to have other tech companies create ways to verify. What's your
Yeah,
take on that?
this is God, this is the age-old gambit by tech. The answer to the problems with tech is more tech. No, I don't think that's always the right answer, and I don't think it's the right answer here. And for folks who are asking why I'm saying that, there was this big moral panic over fake news in the United States in 2016, and the answer was more tech. Facebook will work with CNN, Wikipedia will work with YouTube, and this way we're somehow going to solve the problem. But here we are 10 years later, we're talking about AI. Things have gotten more complicated, not better. But no, the radical idea of democracy is that it's a government of, by, and for the people, and that rests on the radical idea that people are intellectually capable of making decisions collectively for the good of a country. Whenever we decide to put the power in the hands of some other entity to determine what's true or what's false, we really reduce the radical capabilities of democracy. So, do I need another big tech company to tell me what's true or false? Absolutely not. I don't think that's the right answer. Are there regulations we could put in place where tech companies could be held liable for false content that they help spread? Yes, we could. And the reason why that's important, then it would be incumbent on them to spend their money to prove something is true. So, for example, if they get accused of allowing false information on their social media platform or in their AI chatbot, any damage that's done from that, they should be on the hook for. Now, if they want to make the case that the information was not false, good, they can pay for the research to prove that in a court of law. But right now, there's nothing like that. These companies get to make a ton of money from false content getting spread. A lot of lives are ruined, and there's really no accountability. And allowing the industry to come in to say what's true and is false is simply just another money-making opportunity for them. It's not an opportunity to actually help democracy.
And what about the role of government in terms of controlling what people can talk about. I mean, I think there's definitely some people who made the argument in the early 2020s that the best thing to do regarding vaccine disinformation was to like block accounts of people who were saying that like vaccines cause autism and that kind of thing. What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's never a good idea to empower anybody, whether it be government or a big tech company, to determine what people in a supposedly free society can and can't see. I understand the concern over vaccines, but I mean there's a lot of stuff you could do outside of censorship to help with that. So, number one, this is written about by scholars such as Catherine Olmsted of UC Davis. She talks about how government secrecy is what breeds conspiracy. When you live in a free society and your government is supposed to be transparent and accountable to the people, yet it keeps doing things and not giving you answers and hiding information, people tend to fill in that void with a conspiracy. And so when it comes to things like vaccines, one of the things that vaccine skeptics were demanding during COVID, they wanted more transparency on the process by which vaccines were approved and the research that went into them. Now, some of these companies said, no, we want to protect that information. It's proprietary. But this is where the financial incentives for companies come at the expense of democracy. I think it would have been a lot better to be transparent about this process. And the government seemed to have no interest in this. And it wasn't just a right-wing thing. People forget then candidate Kamala Harris went on the campaign trail right before the 2020 election, and she said she wouldn't take the vaccine because she didn't trust this president. So it was across the ideological spectrum. People were spreading this. I think transparency could have gone a long way. I think censorship becomes problematic because we could all agree on a list of things maybe we want censored, right? Some people want the misinformation about vaccines causing autism to be censored. Other people want white supremacist content censored. Other people want foreign propaganda censored. That's great. We can make our big list. But the real question is, who do you trust to only censor that content and censor it accurately and not abuse that power? I think most people would tell you in the United States they don't trust the government, they don't trust corporate America, they don't trust political actors. The answer is they don't trust anyone. And really, the radical idea of democracy is you shouldn't trust anyone. You should trust yourself to be able to sift through information. You should be humble enough to admit when you don't know something and reach out to people who possibly do. But this idea of censorship, what we shouldn't censor, I think it's a slippery slope and brings us down the exact wrong road.
How does your profession and how does this context in terms of the conversation about how to educate people about media, about mass media, how does that tie into this concept of critical media citizenship that you talk about in your book?
Well, so one of the things that critical media literacy hopes to do is teach students how to think, not what to think. So we don't give them lists of this is good media or bad media, or this is true or this is false. We give them a framework of questions and things to look at to make determinations on their own. That's true education. Real education, people don't need to rely on. They have the skills to go out and do it themselves. But this, begs the question, okay, so look at media for what purpose? And from a critical perspective, we really believe in furthering democracy, issues of social and environmental justice. And for democracy, it's incumbent on citizens to be able to tell what's true, what's false, and be able to evaluate arguments as compelling or otherwise, right? This is the idea of democracy. So, for example, in 2020, we talked about the murder of George Floyd. Was an unarmed black man who was murdered by police on camera.
Right.
And, millions of people turned out in the months after that murder to support the idea that Black Lives Matter. N none of those people, none of those, most of those people had never met George Floyd. They had never been to his community. But they saw what had happened in media. They saw the reporting on it. They heard the statistics and they were moved to go to the streets. That's democracy at its best when the news media produces information that people use to try and pressure government to achieve policy goals. That's kind of the ideal democracy. But that process can be obviously manipulated with false content that motivates people to either do nothing or do things against their interest. And media literacy is a way to kind of help patch that hole, to make people more aware of the information, how it's flowing, what are the possible pitfalls, how can they use it so they can participate in their democracy as an active democratic citizen. So that's the connection between the two.
What are the major actors who are trying to make that a reality, though? Because it seems like most of the factors, in terms of money, in terms of who owns large sections of the internet, in terms of the government itself, seem to be primarily aligned with the people who have the most interest in keeping things exactly the way they are.
Our campaign finance system leaves a lot to be desired, to say the least. We America has always had a race between two conflicting systems, which are democracy and capitalism. And in capitalism, those who have the most money have the most power and most influence. Democracy, the power is supposed to be evenly distributed amongst the people. In practice, capitalism transitions that economic power into political power, and that's definitely a problem we've had from the, especially for the last 15 years since the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling effectively allowed outside money to enter campaigns almost endlessly. So we have that problem here in the United States, but it's also an age-old problem. You can go back and look at the late 19th century. The progressive movement was all about this idea about distributing money more equally as a way to save democracy. And I think we're in one of those moments right now. A lot of people in this country realized in 2015, 2016 that the status quo was not going to do it. They wanted a more economic populist agenda. On the left, that meant supporting Bernie Sanders, and the right, that meant supporting Donald Trump. The Democratic Party, which effectively was the center, decided to neutralize the Bernie movement. So some of those populists went to Trump. And Trump has been able to kind of cash in on that populist rhetoric, not populist policy, but populist rhetoric, for almost the last decade, because Democrats don't really offer an alternative. So to your point, you have two political parties that are both maintaining the status quo, but at least Republicans rhetorically are acting like they're fighting the status quo, where Democrats are just defending it.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that the Democrats are trying to patch up a sinking ship without much likelihood of success.
Oh, they're cooked. Donald Trump has had a horrible first 10 months in office. He's some of the biggest issues that he polled well in, immigration, the economy. He's seen huge nosedives. But the Democrats, their brand has stayed low. They have not gained in new voters. And remember, they're coming off a huge loss in 2024. Democrats seem they're afraid of offering any alternative because their donors, the ones who benefit from the status quo, they know they're not going to fund them if they don't maintain the status quo. So if they go, they being Democrats, if they go in this more populist direction, they risk losing donor support. And that donor support may go to someone who's going to oppose them in a race. So you don't have a lot of incentive on the Democratic side to offer a different or more populist agenda. And as a result, this fight continues between the circular firing squad that is the left in America.
That's a very funny way to put it, circular firing squad. Well, thank you very much for your time, Dr. Higdon. I appreciated this discussion. I hope that a lot of people have the opportunity to pick up your book. That's Anatomy of Fake News, a Critical News Literacy Education, and use it in their classrooms or their households.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for being on here. It was a great talk to you. Appreciate it.
You have just heard our interview with Dr. Nolan Higdon about his book, The Anatomy of Fake News, from University of California Press. You can find more episodes of this podcast on our website, bridgingthebones.fyi. Bridging the Bones is an independent podcast free of influence from Fortune 500 companies, governments, or political parties. Thanks this week to DS Technician for the audio track, Life. This is your host, Rumi Wang, signing off.